Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 2nd of April, the opening day of baseball for the Milwaukee Brewers. I decided to become a big-time fan this year. I need something else. You need something else, so it's going to be baseball. So this is a big day. And Frank Rich is on the air with us. This is a big day. Before we get rolling with Frank, I want to thank the 70 listeners who joined me and Rhonda and Bill Estes and Sandy Leuenauer and John Treader at the IMAX Milwaukee Public Museum yesterday. We had a wonderful time. We saw the underwater film, The Deep Sea, and we looked at the museum and talked to people who came from all over the state. It was wonderful to meet you, and rural mail carriers and people doing construction work, and it was just it was a grand day, so thanks for coming. We'll have another event sometime soon. Frank Rich is our guest. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, the guy I read every Sunday morning. It's the first thing I do on Sunday morning, make the coffee, read Frank Rich. Before this assignment, he was the front-page columnist for the Sunday Arts and Leisure section, serves as senior advisor to the Times Culture editor on the paper's overall cultural news report. He's been at the paper since 1980. When he was chief theater critic, he has written for the New York Times Magazine. His latest book is The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. He also was a film and TV critic at Time Magazine some years ago. He graduated from Harvard in 71, where he studied American history and literature. He's incredibly literate, and, you know, I thought this when I heard the Elizabeth Edwards story, and just felt that this story is going to find its way into our hearts and heads in a very dramatic way. And he wrote a column about Elizabeth Edwards yesterday that I urge you to read, in which he puts into words what I think I was feeling. If Mr. Edwards can stay in this race for the duration, the more Elizabeth Edwards is in the spotlight, the more everyone else in the arena will have to be judged against her. Next to her stark humanity, the slick play acting that passes for being human and folksy in a campaign is tinny. She's a model of personal transparency to everyone else in the presidential race, especially this is true in a campaign where the presumptive frontrunners in both parties have made candor their calling cards. We're going to welcome phone calls for Frank. I can guarantee you our lines will get very busy, so if you know what you want to say, call in now. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Hello, Frank.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I just loved yesterday's column because,
thank you. You
know, I've been going, when I got the news, it knocked me out about her, and it knocked me out for the very reasons that you wrote about. So you put to words all that I've been feeling about her, and I've had a chance to interview her a couple times, and she's just a terrific woman. I like this woman so much, and I don't want her to have cancer again, and it puts this whole new element in the campaign, and boy, you nailed it yesterday. It's honesty, it's truth, it's life and death, it's all of that.
Well, you know, I think that first of all, she was an impressive woman, of course, before she ever got ill. And by the way, one thing I didn't mention in the column that I would also point out is that she's written a wonderful memoir after her first bout with cancer, but it's about much more than that. It's called Saving Graces. It's about her childhood, about bringing up her children, about, of course, the tragic loss of a son in a horrific car accident.
Mm-hmm.
So she's quite interesting. I think that you know, this flies in the face of a lot of things in this country. First of all, the way we view it, death, at least in the public arena, it's often turned into a kind of circus sideshow. I mean, look at the feasting on Anna Nicole Smith that went on, you know, for weeks. And here is someone who said, in the case of Elizabeth Edwards, I'm sick. Here's my oncologist. This is exactly how I'm sick.
Mm-hmm.
This is the decision my husband and I have made about how to go forward. This is it. And it's a very brave decision. And they, I thought, very explicitly, you know, did not want to crawl into a room and wait for the possibility that she might die.
Mm-hmm.
What shocked me, what provoked me to write the column, was how many people, regardless whether they're liberal or conservative, particularly political pundits, felt that they could just intrude into this decision and pass judgment and make claims that they were somehow hurting their children, or they didn't know what they were doing, or this is how I would do it. It was really kind of revolting. And I think one reason why the Katie Couric, who didn't really ask questions that were all that unfair and whom the Edwards have not complained about, but I think her 60 Minutes interview got her in much trouble because her tone sounded so judgmental. You know, it's quite something. At the same time, as you alluded to, we have a campaign where on the Republican side we have John McCain riding the straight talk express. We have Hillary Clinton let the conversation begin.
Right.
But we're not having a real conversation with Hillary Clinton, and McCain is not really talking straight talk. And here was a couple that came out and talked some straight talk.
Right. And then we got the Giulianis, and we can't remember how many marriages we've had.
And the thing about Giuliani, which of course is at this point much more interest to those of us in New York than around the country, forget about how many times they've been married. You know, they won't say how they met. They won't say how Rudy Giuliani and Judy Nathan will not say actually how they met. What's that about? So it's the antithesis of the Edwardses.
Right. And yet I think that, you know, one of the reasons I think McCain really flew the last go around was the straight talk express really was a straight talk express, and that we're hungry in this country for this, so that we've now got this, as you write, Elizabeth Edwards as a yardstick, and that there she is, and it's honest and it's direct. And so we judge all these other kind of manufactured cheese whiz, as you say, campaigns, and say, wait a second, it's not ringing true. It's not authentic.
Well, exactly, and what all politicians seem to realize is Americans love authenticity. So then, for many politicians, the issue becomes, well, how can we best fake authenticity? So, you know, whether you put a name on a bus, or in the case of Hillary Clinton, people should go look at her website and look at these web chats she does, where every question is just perfectly fielded and the whole thing feels scripted, whether it is or not. I think one point I made in the column, I really believe, is that parody of that old Apple commercial presenting her as Big Brother took off and had the resonance it did because it hit on something with the public. It hit on the feeling that when she says, let's have a conversation, let the conversation begin, they're really being talked at, not with.
Mm-hmm. But she raised $26 million. What does that mean, Frank?
It means that this is going to be a very expensive campaign.
Oh, yeah.
But I think we have to reconcile, reconcile ourselves to the fact that all these campaigns, all the candidates in both parties is going to be big money. They've all opted out of federal strictures that would require them to rein it in. And one thing we have to look at with all of them is where this money is coming from and who wants what for that money.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a few moments about Alberto Gonzalez. The column last week looked at the president's ties with Alberto Gonzalez that go way back. And you reminded us of some stories about the two of them that probably many people didn't know about.
Well, Alberto Gonzalez, who seems to have no serious qualifications for being attorney general, even before this latest jam, beyond being a crony of the president's going back to Texas, has been sort of the zealot of the Bush career in terms of always being there in sort of thorny legal moments. We know, for instance, that when Bush, as governor of Texas in 1996, was called for jury duty, he very publicly said, I'd like to do jury duty, I'll be an average guy on the jury, even though I'm a governor. Then suddenly his tune changed when it turned out that he had to fill out a standard questionnaire that required dealing with any accusations of breaking the law. And there had been a couple in the case of Bush, including most famously a driving while intoxicated incident. But those incidents were not known then. It was Gonzalez, as Bush's attorney, who turned up in an Austin courtroom and behind closed doors got Bush out of jury duty. Gonzalez has been involved, obviously, in some of the most, egregious memos, in essence, condoning torture. He's in every little thing. I also point out a forgotten incident in the whole Libby Wilson, Valerie Wilson leak case, is that when the Justice Department, at the request of George Tenet, the CIA, decided to have an official investigation to the leak, Gonzalez held off officially telling the White House staff overnight, even though he told Andy Card, the chief of staff at that time, which led Chuck Schumer, among others, to question whether documents could have been destroyed while there was that little pause. Now, maybe this is all incompetence. Maybe it's all coincidence. Maybe what seems to be blatant lying about what he did and didn't do with these cashiered attorneys is just amnesia. He seems to never recollect anything. As I pointed out in my column, he would later say he had no recollection of having a meeting with the judge in his quarters about the Bush jury duty.
You quote him saying that, "I'm not going to resign. I'm going to stay focused on protecting our kids." Actually, he's going to stay focused on protecting the president. Once he can no longer be useful in that role, it's a sure thing that, like Scooter before him, Fredo will be tossed overboard. Don't you think that time has arrived?
I think it has arrived, and it's hard to figure out what's exactly going on. Gonzalez has no support among Republicans in Congress. Maybe tacit support from Hatch, you know, in the Judiciary Committee, and that is about it. There's no one defending him. This has been true for days, if not weeks. So what's going on? I don't know. It's a two-week recess in Congress. Some people are saying that when they come back and Gonzalez is supposed to testify on April 17th, that'll be when they give him the hook. I don't know. Always with these cases, with this administration, you wonder if Gonzalez is more valuable. They're worried about him. They're worried about him going off the reservation. But at a certain point, if the government can't function, the Justice Department can't function, and he can't protect Bush on any of this, he's going to have to get out.
Yeah. We're going to take phone calls. Frank Rich is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. And we start with Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I'm taking it that this show just isn't about John and Elizabeth Edwards, right?
No, it's Frank Rich. Take on whatever you want.
Okay. Well, what I want is Mr. Rich's comments on some of my concerns, and that is that in this age of public oversight of personal lives, but not public oversight of public matters, we have really the most dramatic military privatization scheme that has ever hit the United States, Blackwater USA. And this has really led to a bleeding of from the military of soldiers who basically say, why should I be serving my country in the Army? Why can't I be making, pardon the expression, a killing by going Blackwater? Mm-hmm. And Blackwater is expanding from North Carolina to Northern Illinois to California to training in the Philippines. And really, we have as many people, the United States has as many people in Iraq that are private contractors as we have in our armed forces.
All right, let's get a response. Frank?
Well, I don't disagree with anything the caller is saying. It's been one of the great undercover stories, you know, and it goes back to the very beginning, to the siege of Fallujah, where those four contractors were strung up in one of the more horrific early instances of violence against Americans when the war in Iraq started to go really bad. The administration has tried to privatize everything they can, including, one might add, veterans' health care, which accounts for some of the problems that went on at Walter Reed. And there's been no accounting for it. It's been all off the books. And now journalists are, you know, and have been for a while now, stepping up to the plate and dealing with it. There's a major book about Blackwater, and I'm embarrassed to say I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know the title or the author. I think it's a writer from The Nation that's coming out in the next week or two.
We just interviewed him, Frank, on Friday, and it's a terrific book. And the guy is a kid who's from Wisconsin, didn't graduate from college, is one of the finest investigative reporters. He's terrific. You got to call him. You got to meet him. It's debuting at number 9 on the New York Times bestseller list on Sunday.
Well, I'm it's very much on my list of something I want to read.
Right.
There was a terrific book called Blood Money by a reporter for the Los Angeles Times named T. Christian Miller. It came out about 6 months ago. That's about the privatization and the corruption of the whole reconstruction of Iraq. And that overlaps much more than just Blackwater or Halliburton. And it's a scandal. And it is an ideological point of this administration to do it. Furthermore, the more we learn, the more we know it's cronies involved of the administration at times, and not just Dick Cheney's supposedly entrust Halliburton options that are enriching themselves off.
Frank Rich, our guest and the author of that. I can't remember the exact title either. Maybe Rhonda's listening. Jeremy Scahill is the author. Terrific young guy. We're going to take more phone calls. Frank, thank you for your call. We'll go to more calls in a moment. Frank Rich is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Rich is our guest. Let's talk about Iraq for a few more moments here, Frank. You hear these numbers and you listen to the news coming into work, and every day it's the same thing, the bombings, and it's just the only difference is the number of people who have been killed. 1,861 civilian deaths in March, an increase of 16% the month before. What's the Congress to do with this? It strikes me that the surge may not be working here, and it's just... We need a new path. So what is it and who gets us there?
Well, I think it's going to have to be Congress. And in the end, it's going to have to be Republicans in Congress. The fact is that the House and the Senate, despite the discrepancies between them, basically have a plan that most Americans agree with. And they do not have the votes to override a veto. So what will happen now, I presume, is a veto, and then if the bill, if that cannot be overcome, and it may not be able to, I'm sure the Democrats will in some way fund the troops anyway, but it's a part of a process that's going to keep on, because whether you look at Norm Coleman or whoever you want to look at, who is now beginning to hedge on the war in the Senate and the House, the pressure is going to step up. And so I look at this as the beginning of a process. The fact is that the administration has no plan. If we have a lot of American troops in Baghdad, we can temporarily reduce violence in Baghdad. But as we're seeing, it's like pushing air under a carpet. It's just popping up everywhere else, and it remains horrific, except where the American troops right are, unless we are going to stay there forever, then what does this lead to? Mm-hmm. Nothing. Mm-hmm. It's not, because there's been no political solution in Iraq, no benchmarks for the Iraqi government. The administration doesn't want them. So at some level, it seems the administration plan is just to kick this past, the next presidential inauguration. And it's going to be up to Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, to force some changes.
We go to Boyd next from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello, Mr. Rich.
Hi.
I just want to get back to John Edwards briefly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think with him being from the South, if he were to get the nomination, the Democrats might still be trying to woo some states in the South? I know there's been a number of books that have come up where they're sort of at the crossroads, and some have argued very effectively that for now at least, they should entirely write the South off, where actually the big battleground is, well, here, the Midwest and the Rust Belt. And
right, and also the Rocky Mountain states, I would say.
Yeah, exactly, the Rocky Mountains, too. And I can certainly see one person's argument, because I can remember when Bush was campaigning, you didn't really see him get up to New York and Massachusetts with a Red Sox cap on, trying to, woo them. What would you think about that?
Well, I'm not an expert on voting patterns in the South. My feeling is that probably most of the South is not in play for the Democrats in a presidential race. But there's obviously there's beginning to be some changes, and I can't imagine the Democrats would write it off. And indeed, it's more in the border states where you're seeing it, particularly in a state like Virginia. I would not underestimate Jim Webb beating George Allen.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, George Allen did everything he could to shoot himself in the foot, but that's quite a change. And what it reflects is a demographic change in Virginia, where the northern Virginia suburbs and the high-tech industries there are bringing in a kind of voter that's not the traditional southern voter, a voter that votes more like a Silicon Valley voter. And so you're seeing some changes there, perhaps in North Carolina, where Edwards is from. But, you know, overall, it's hard to picture the Democrats winning huge gains in the South. That said, they pick up a state there even. That's a plus. And meanwhile, to win the election, they really just have to, turn a couple of states. They particularly, again, have to win Ohio and Florida. And they're both up for grabs, obviously.
Yeah.
And a few thousand votes can change it. So it's a very open race. And meanwhile, the Republicans are finding themselves having to defend areas that they haven't normally had to defend, including places in some, like, New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado. At the same time, the Democrats don't have the hammerlock on Minnesota anymore that they once did. So it's very interesting. A lot's in flux. I think the South is probably the least movable piece of it, however.
Yeah. Why don't you just briefly go through, because you've written about, you said yesterday that you have some reservations about Edwards. I know you got a lot of reservations about Hillary. You're intrigued by Obama. I want to learn more.
I think I'm like most Americans. I think if we're going to have this long campaign, one thing we can get out of it is see actual debate, see how people behave mm-hmm. under pressure. And I'm actually open-minded about all of them, and I'm also open-minded to listening to Republicans, too. I think a lot could happen. I think that the political class sort of going into this just had it sort of wrapped up for McCain on the Republican side and Clinton on the Democratic side. And I think now what's going on is a hold-your-horses period where people are not only looking at Obama and John Edwards on the Democratic side or Mitt Romney and Giuliani on the Republican side, but we don't know if some of these candidates that are mere asterisks now might amount to something.
Tommy Thompson from Wisconsin.
Tommy Thompson.
Yeah.
Bill Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I better than I whether Tommy Thompson is really plausible candidate, but you just don't know. And some of these people are going to blow up, no matter how much money they have. And there's tremendous divisions in the Republican Party, and it's very interesting. Then you have wild cards, both Al Gore and Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, have indicated that they're not running. They haven't quite completely shut the door. And Bloomberg has in a way, but there's even as recently as last week, there was a Washington Post front page story speculating that in private he does think about some kind of independent bid. So it's kind of interesting. There are a lot of compelling candidates out there, no matter what your political mm-hmm. ideology, and so we should sit back and watch them all be tested.
Okay. Let's go to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Regarding last week's Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, removing Gonzales is not going to be enough, I don't think. Karl Rove is the hub of Bush's vicious policy. And since he's the engineer, someone suggested on Talk program this weekend that because Rove knows absolutely everything about Bush's past, and I'm sure about Cheney's and everybody else's in the administration, if he's fired or forced to resign, he's not at all above blackmailing, and that threats to blackmail I'm not saying they are, I have no evidence, but might be the reason that the Bush administration especially circles the wagons around Karl Rove. And I also wondered about, in the Valerie Plame, verdict, whether the reason he wasn't charged with discussing Valerie Plame's background with Matt Cooper might be that he made a very ugly and, very threatening comment or something to the special prosecutor to blackmail him.
Frank.
Well, I just, these are theories that I I have no idea if there's any credence to them at all. I think that to just take it at a much simpler level, if you have an administration that's riddled with scandal, they're always the president is always going to try to keep the person who knows the most secrets inside. Whether it's and it doesn't have to be blackmail, it's common sense. That's why, you know, until things got so bad it just couldn't do it anymore, Nixon kept Haldeman and Ehrlichman, who occupied positions very much comparable to Karl Rove's, to the bitter end before he finally cast them out. So, I don't think you have to have literally blackmail. I think it's just common sense. You want to keep your closest allies around, particularly those who knew all the secrets, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. What are you looking for in terms of congressional investigations? We got a recess going on now. There's some talk about the Democrats wanting to close Guantanamo, looking a lot more at who's been spied on. Are we in for a 6 months of heavy-duty investigations?
I don't know. I hope there should be investigations, obviously, but they have to be targeted and they have to be smart. What we don't want to see is a bunch of Congress people, Democrats included, bloviating about what we already know that's gone wrong. We need target investigations. An example would be Henry Waxman, who is now trying to actively look into the falsified intelligence about uranium from Africa, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we definitely need a real investigation of what's going on in Gitmo and the treatment of detainees in general. We have to get to the bottom of the Attorney General Justice Department mess. But at a certain point, governing has to go on too. And so, mm-hmm. you know, everyone has a laundry list of grievances against this administration. And we have to hope that on the part of both the Senate and House leadership, they'll exercise some discretion in editing of their impulses,
mm-hmm.
to deal with the highest priorities and not get hung up on every last thing.
I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes last night, but I can't believe this pharmaceutical industry getting away with what they get away with. It was a really interesting piece.
I'll have to check it. I missed it, I'm afraid, but
yeah.
I will.
Yeah, it's definitely worth seeing, and maybe Medicare will change. Maybe we can get lower prescription drug prices.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, it'd be something. Frank, you're a real treasure. I must tell you, and I'm sure I'm not alone, you are really the first person I read in the morning.
Well, thank you. I'm very flattered.
Yeah.
It's just so nice to talk to you. I'm really grateful for you having me on.
Yeah, well, we're grateful to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Frank Rich, our guest, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. We're going to continue talking politics. Ed Miller will be joining us in just a moment, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. So we'll look at congressional investigations, the war in Iraq, the incredible amount of money being spent on the presidential race. And welcoming your phone calls, so the lines are still open for you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. We are going to do a show sometime soon on this prescription drug business and why this industry really hasn't been investigated and the influence they have among Republicans and Democrats in Congress. And the Democrats now saying that they really want Medicare to be able to bargain lower prices for prescription drugs. So we'll look at that issue fairly soon. And, welcome phone calls. And joining us now, as we continue in the same vein, political vein, Professor Ed Miller, who's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Professor Ed Miller, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
We started with Elizabeth Edwards and Frank's column yesterday, which I thought was a wonderful column about her, that they put this idea of dealing with, you know, the hardships in life, that there's nothing phony about what's going on with them. And so you have to expect other campaigns to live up to that, that we've got too much superficiality going on. You know, let's have a conversation, let's be real. And yet things are still being governed by focus groups, et cetera. So that it adds this element to the campaign that's different, don't you think?
Well, yeah, it is. It is different, but it's a tragedy that they're coping with, and it's a serious situation. Her first bout of cancer was also it was not the simplest matter. They didn't release all the information, but if you look at the treatment, the way the treatment was done and the order of the treatment, you knew it was more serious than. you know, than a small isolated tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that it came back was not overly surprising.
No, not surprising at all.
And it would be very difficult for them not to release it.
Right. But the way they've dealt with it is just so genuine that they contrast this with other campaigns that maybe are telling people what they want to hear or that don't – there's not as much authenticity with it. And so we've got somebody who's authentic here.
Right, right. And I think they're going to – and, you know, and she is going to be dealing with treatment a lot during this campaign, certainly. He's going to be out campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have a day job.
Right.
So, I mean, one of his advantages is, I mean, he could do both because of the fact is other candidates are either in the Senate or something like, or, you know, governor, which takes, a lot of time. And so, he can be out campaigning as well as helping her with the treatment.
Yeah. So let's talk about the money here. $26 million, and we're so far away from an election for Hillary Clinton. I think Edwards at $16 million. Barack maybe at $20. It's not released yet. Holy Toledo, is there a lot of dough involved here?
Right. There's, campaigns have become much more expensive, it seems as if it's an arms race. Money is used certainly
right.
for advertising, organizing, as well as polls. And so not only, is there more money, but each of those the elements have become more expensive. So it's
mm-hmm.
not only that you're buying more stuff, but each of the stuff you're buying is more expensive because they know that they can make money there. So these are – and the problem with that, one of the problems with that is they have to spend so much time raising money. And it does eliminate some very good candidates that are not able to raise, that amount of money or don't want to raise that amount of money even if they could.
And what does it mean? The news reports this morning were that the Clinton campaign was giddy with these results. Does it really solidify her and make her almost impossible to beat to have gathered that much money at this point in the campaign?
No, because the front runner will – if another person emerges as a front runner, there will be a considerable amount of money going to that individual. She does have – early money is obviously good. It's always been the case that early money is better than late money because
mm-hmm.
of the fact is you can plan, the expenditures of the money. And so that's an advantage to her. And she has a lot of other advantages. However, if you look historically, you will see a lot of the front runners, especially at this stage, don't wind up being the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't say that it's certainly a sure thing by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. You would think that all of these people would be fed up with it. Wouldn't you, going to all these fundraisers? Whatever happened to public financing? It's gone.
Right, right. Public, yeah, because you have to abide by the limits, and Hillary Clinton indicated that she would abide by the limits, neither for the primary or the general.
Mm-hmm.
Although in the past, some of the candidates did not do it for the primary, but they did for the general election. But she indicated that pretty early because she was raising a lot of money.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for Ed. Our phone number remaining the same. Ed Miller, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. We are talking about a number of political issues. The financial statements released by various campaigns yesterday showing that Hillary Clinton had amassed the greatest amount of money. We'll also be looking at more at what the Democrats have said that they will take on when they return from their spring recess, and that's closing perhaps the prison at Guantanamo Bay, reining in what Democrats see as unwarranted steps on privacy and civil liberties. We'll talk about a number of issues as well. The Iraq, what's going on in Iraq, whether or not the surge is working. We can look more at Alberto Gonzalez. You take us politically where you'd like with Professor Miller. The number and lines are open. Join us this Monday, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today will be our April open line, so you can call with your suggestions for topics, guests. That's the second hour today. All right. Returning now to phone calls, we go to Reed from Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Good morning to you, Kathleen, and your guest. Forgive me, his name is Dr. Miller?
Yes.
Yes, OK. Okay. I would like to just mention the news article, and I don't know the source, but one of the current president's close confidants, who now no longer works evidently in the White House, just came out with a statement that John Kerry was correct. And so perhaps Dr. Miller could speak to that, but very quickly, as long as we're in Wisconsin and we have three Wisconsin people here, I did see Tommy Thompson's announcement yesterday on
ABC,
mm-hmm. and he presented himself extremely poorly. I thought he was a very, very poor speaker and appeared totally unprepared for questions that George Stephanopoulos had for him.
Appeared unprepared in what way,
Well,
Reed?
He just did not seem to, though he had some general answers, he did not seem to have a very professional ability to respond cogently and just seemed not to present himself well professionally. But I might ask a very one quick question yet, and then I'll hang up and listen. And that is, Fred Thompson on the Republican side seems to be rising somewhat meteorically, but might one think that many of these people that are now getting into the race are hoping that they do well enough that they'll perhaps get a nod as vice president?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, why don't you start with Tommy Thompson's announcement, Professor Miller?
Oh, when was it? It was over the weekend.
Right.
He actually announced the that his candidacy, but he's been in Iowa and for some time he has indicated that he was going to run for president. All those former announcements, I believe, came over the weekend.
And what do you think his chances are?
I think it's pretty slim. I don't think he has very much support. He has very, very little money, since we already talked about money.
Mm-hmm.
He is counting on Iowa, which is interesting, because he thinks that because it's a neighboring state, and he's been in Iowa multiple times, that if he wins Iowa, then there will be sort of a movement in his direction. I don't think he has the political base to become president.
What about being tapped for vice president? He's from the Midwest. He's been in the administration. He's run a state.
Right.
People love him here. It seems to me as though he might be bringing important votes to a Republican ticket.
It could be. It could be. You did mention, one of the key interesting elements, and that is of all the states, they're not very competitive, now. Many of the states are not competitive. And so you're talking about these what they now call the battleground states in Wisconsin. Even though we don't have many electoral votes, we actually have lost one after the last census. But the fact is that even though we don't, we are one of the states that are about 50-50, and so adding him to the ticket would not be a bad idea, at least in terms of that. Whether he's got any chance, I don't know. In that area, in terms of the Republican who, as Reed said, who indicated that Bush would not be his choice, and that was doubt. But the fact is that one thing to indicate a president may be in trouble is when members of his own party begin opposing him. And we see this not only in terms of, the announcement, last week, at the end of last week, by Dowd, but also the fact is that there's some members of Congress who are not supporting him, and there's in various policy areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see this break, and so that indicates there's a problem. And this has typically been the case of in presidents, and especially in more recent era where there's been more solid party support for their own party's president.
Thanks very much, Reed, for the call. Sally from Middleton. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi, Sally.
I couldn't believe Governor Thompson when I heard his two statements yesterday. His main theme is that he left the state as governor debt-free. I left no money. Bills were paid. Well, isn't that flat-out wrong? Didn't both Doyle and Tony Earle have a whole 4 years to try to dig out of the money that we owed everybody? I don't remember what portions. I know the cigarette tax that Doyle worked so hard to get. that was supposed to be prorated out over the years. Thompson used that up in a flash, all of it. And I don't know how he can present himself with being this fiscal conservative.
Well, that is exactly a problem. We had a structural deficit during the era of Thompson, but the advantage that Thompson had was that the economy, when he was governor, was doing extremely well. I mean, the national economy and the state of Wisconsin economy as well. And so as a result, even though we had this structural deficit, which means that some of the bills were then being paid the following year, we were able to do that because our economy was growing. Once the recession hit after 2000, the fact is that then the bills came home, so to speak. And that's what Doyle, when he was then elected, was faced with, this significant deficit to deal with that. But Sally's absolutely right that there was a deficit during that earlier period of time, too.
Thanks, Sally, for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Professor Ed Miller is with us now, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. We're talking about the presidential race. We are talking about Congress. We're talking about money in races. Tommy Thompson's announcement yesterday that he is in the presidential race. And whatever you want to put on the table politically, we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Eileen from Menominee Falls. Hi, Eileen.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. I'd like for the professor to tell me how I could feel better if I knew what the goal was now for all this fighting. We got Saddam. We gave him the vote. What are we fighting for now? We don't want to own Iraq. So I'd feel better if I knew why he's sacrificing all our young men. And they never talk about what the end point should be or what we would like it to be. And thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, that's a significant problem. You know, what is the goal? And even if you come up with a goal, whether it's reachable, I think the overarching goal is stability in Iraq and a functioning government. But whether you could ever, you know, reach this stability with the three different factions may be questionable. And this is why Biden, for example, Senator Biden and the Council on Foreign Relations president have proposed actually more of a division of Iraq. It's currently the structure, actually it's the federal structure that they developed, but more of autonomy for the provinces. Right now the Kurds in their province are pretty autonomous. And the idea was that if you could provide autonomy in two other areas, then maybe some stability would be achieved. Because essentially we're having interstate warfare that is occurring there, and we're sort of right in the center. And so what we're afraid of is that if we pulled out, that not only would this continue, but that more groups would then come in to take advantage of it, and that's what we want to avoid, because there's a power vacuum. Essentially, and we're particularly concerned about Iran. But how we get out of this situation is obviously the question, which is unanswered.
Seems a shame to sacrifice our young people for that.
Well, it's a shame, and it's, I mean, it's a, obviously one of the tragedies. Some people claim that it's even worse than Vietnam.
Yeah.
But exactly how we're going to get out is the interesting question. And Democrats have proposed the gradual withdrawal. And both the bills, particularly the House bill, has this gradual withdrawal in there, and where the Iraqi government has to meet certain benchmarks, but then ultimately we withdraw. So there is a withdrawal plan that they have. The Senate also has a less strong but withdrawal plan as well in the Senate bill. But if they reconcile these two bills, the president has vowed to veto them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've got the problem, and how do you get out of it is unknown.
Thanks, Eileen, for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Scott from Madison next. Hi, Scott.
Hi there.
Hi,
good morning to you both. And I didn't tell the screener this, but I just want to make a quick aside here. I was at the event yesterday at the Milwaukee Public Museum with you folks, and I would like to encourage all of the listeners, if at all possible, to attend one of these, and they can attend one of these to do so. It was a wonderful time, and thank you.
Oh, thanks for coming. We had a great time, too. Thanks, Scott.
It was great. Yeah, I just thoroughly enjoyed the entire experience.
Great.
And, you know, I drove over from Madison for it.
Thank you.
But my question is, I have heard that that come late summer, fall, even the Republicans will be probably turning against this war and surge if it's shown to be not working. The question I have is, how will you know? I mean, what kind of a, you know, we have John McCain going there over the weekend with helicopters flying above him and security all over the lot, which I'm assuming was provided by Blackwater, saying, hey, it's working. Well, you know, I'm sure for the average Iraqi going out to shop in a market for an hour, they don't have that kind of security with them. So how are we going to know?
Well, and Scott is absolutely right. You wouldn't know because it's obvious when the surge comes in the area that the troops are, there is a reduction in violence, but you could imagine that would be the case, but that we can't continue to patrol these areas, and I seriously doubt that even the Iraqis can continue to patrol these areas in that force situation. And you need the force situation if the government lacks legitimacy. So, and the government obviously lacks legitimacy in some individuals' minds. And so once the force begins to be reduced, the violence will return. So even if the benchmark was the number of incidents that occurs, and if the number of incidents dropped, and it is dropping in the area that the surge is taking place, but not in some other areas of Iraq, which was one of the criticisms of McCain's comment, but even if that occurs, it could be a temporary phenomenon and not a permanent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Yeah, well, so then do you think that even, let's say that come summer and fall, there are these, you know, continuing violence and, you know, lots of bombings and all the rest, that we will hear the Republicans in the Congress then coming out and saying, you know, this just isn't working, we can't support this any longer?
I think absolutely, and I think we see some of it now. There's some Republicans now who haven't supported the surge and have backed away from the president's Iraq policy, and I think Scott's absolutely right. There certainly will be more in that way, and the president ultimately will be forced to do something during the last couple months. Exactly what he does is, I don't know.
Very hard to know.
Well, because he wants to obviously mm-hmm. justify the initial entry into Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Thanks,
great.
Scott.
Thanks again so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's go to Laura next from Wausau. Hi, Laura.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Laura.
My question is actually a revisitation of Alberto Gonzalez and the Justice Department debacle that is currently ongoing in Congress. My question is related to those positions where they were not fired. There's been so much discussion about the positions that were released, the people that were released because they refused to perhaps go the way of partisanship and investigate cases that were not favorable to the Republican Party. But my question is there any investigative reporting ongoing at the moment about the people who remained in their positions? And is there perhaps a lot more partisanship within the Justice Department than is currently being reported in the media?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard much of investigation of the other U.S. attorneys. In effect, the U.S. attorneys were replaced initially. Just most administrations, because U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president, and so those U.S. attorneys were replaced. Although, unlike Clinton, where they were replaced all at once, in this case they were replaced over a period of time, and then these additional eight were actually replacing Republicans that had been put into that particular office. And there's still an open question, that's what the investigation is, actually how much politics and how much political influence they were trying to exert. We have some evidence that some of this was true with regard to these eight. We don't know about any others, and that was some, and I assume that will be some of the congressional investigation.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. We have time for one more phone call. We're running short on time, less than a minute. Doug, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning, Doug.
Kathleen, your friend John Nichols was in town in Eau Claire this last weekend, and he made a pretty strong case for impeachment of Bush, and his biggest concern, obviously, besides the four areas of the rampant executive power is the fact that he doesn't want this issue or this situation to be passed on to the next administration. What is your feelings about whether executive or if there's any kind of movement towards impeachment?
No, I think impeachment is pretty slim, given the fact of the problems that we're running run into with Bill Clinton. In this particular case, there is policy. It's essentially policy determination. There may be some violations there, you know, but there may be some interpretation of the rules in terms of those violations. And so I think that would be hard to press for impeachment.
Yeah.
And especially given the fact that we're getting close to a new presidential election.
Thanks, Professor Miller, as always, for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Professor Ed Miller, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. We also thank Frank Rich, columnist for the New York Times, for being with us this first part of this hour. Rhonda Fanning produced the program. Thanks, Rhonda, for production, and Susie Seidelman, on-air production here in our studios. Thanks. Copies of this show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number is 42D. The book that we were talking about, Jeremy Scahill's book about Blackwater, is titled Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. So that's that. We'll be back first. Latest news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.